Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, our roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, as George Clooney and Julia Roberts team up for Money Monster, we'll talk about that movie a bit and about the state of the Hollywood movie star. Then, speaking of larger-than-life phenomena, we will finally dig into the Eurovision Song Contest with the fire, the costumes, and the national pride that it entails. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so don't go away.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Try out the NPR One app for your phone for conversations you won't hear anywhere else. This week, find Guy Raz's exclusive interview with TED curator Chris Anderson, where they discuss the TED phenomenon and the secrets to giving a great TED Talk. Find their conversations by searching TED Radio on the NPR One app, where you can also find stories from your local station, as well as more great podcasts. NPR One is in your app store now.
We've got shining stars and sparkling singers on the show this week, but before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And joining us this week in our fourth chair is one of our very favorite people, Barry Hardiman. What do you do at NPR?
I'm the books editor on Weekend Edition, and I spend a lot of time sitting next to Linda's chair.
That's true. Barry and I spend a lot of time chatting, where she's ripping the lid off of our secret chatting relationship.
I did.
Well, we have Barry with us this week for a conversation that is partly about movie stars, and the context for this conversation is Money Monster, the new film that just opened last week with George Clooney and Julia Roberts, who both, you might have heard, are movie stars. So we're going to talk about that film a little bit, and then we're going to talk about movie stars more generally. And I'm going to swing over to my pal, Stephen Thompson. What did you think of Money Monster?
I liked it. I think it's interesting that this movie came out in mid-May, kind of right as the big summer blockbuster season is starting, because this is not a summer movie. First of all, it is a basic cable kind of movie. but it's also like a mid-September movie, kind of where you start to put your more, let's, shall we say, mature fare, you know, your somewhat more thoughtful movies. This is a thriller, but it's meant to be sort of more of like a thinking person's thriller. It's about the way the system just, you know, sticks it to the man.
Yeah, and we should explain. What happens in this movie is that George Clooney plays the host of a cable show about finance, basically Jim Cramer. And Julia Roberts is his producer. And in the middle of their show one day, a guy comes in with a gun, says he has a bomb, and he's upset about a financier who the George Clooney character had kind of built up, who has lost a bunch of people a bunch of money.
Right.
So he comes in angry about that and ranting about the system and the banks and all that business.
And you have a hostage situation and a story that unfolds pretty interestingly in real time. It plays out over the course of its about 90-minute running time, and everything kind of has to happen within that space.
Right.
Now, obviously, that forces a certain amount of somewhat implausible resolutions in order to get everything tied up. But at the same time, I saw this movie. The time that worked out best for me to see this movie this weekend was at 12:25 in the morning.
Jeez.
And by the time the previews were over, it was like 12:45 in the
Holy
morning.
Cow, and what are you doing?
And I'm a busy person. So by the time it was over, it was probably quarter after two. And I did not feel sleepy. I did not get bored. I did not feel sleepy.
Sounds very much like
the old person's review of the movie. Like, I didn't fall asleep or have to go to the bathroom once.
Faint praise, my friend.
It kind of does.
But it's not faint praise. Like, I didn't think of anything else while I was on. It was very engrossing, absorbing, very skillfully directed by Jodie Foster. I enjoyed it.
If you hanker for the cinematic golden age that was fall 1998, this is your movie.
Yep.
If you enjoy the feeling of sitting in a theater and thinking, have I seen this movie a few times on TBS on Saturday afternoon? Yeah, this is a movie for you. I do think it's fighting against itself. I think the thriller aspects of it are kind of fighting against the comedic aspects. I didn't call them funny. I said comedic. I just think it constantly diffuses its tension by introducing these weird, out of nowhere comedic elements that don't quite, and that should work, right? I mean, in the novels of Elmore Leonard, build up tension, diffuse it with humor.
Sure.
In the films of Quentin Tarantino and Hitchcock, build up tension, diffuse it with humor. It calls itself a taut thriller. I didn't find it particularly taut. Thought there was some luff in there in the sales. And it's not the blistering critique of the financial system that I think the trailers want you to believe it is. So it was fine.
I got you. How about you, Barry?
I think I liked it the least of all these guys. I did find my mind wandering a couple times. Okay. I realize now that it was 90 minutes. It did not actually feel like 90 minutes to me. I enjoy George Clooney and Julia Roberts, but not in this kind of faked thriller thing. And also, I mean, Catriona Balfe is in it, who I adore from Outlander. Sure. I mean, like, there are people that I love in this, but every single thing was telegraphed. The plot device at the very beginning that is set up is going to play out at the end in a way that it's kind of like you just got shot in the head with Chekhov's gun.
Yeah.
But at the same time, had I seen this movie on the couch, had I been flipping through, it would have been the kind of movie that I would have been like, oh, wow. Big stars.
Yeah.
Right.
And it would have given the feeling of the Sunday afternoon couch movie a little bit of an upgrade.
The first couple of reviews that I had seen of this movie were pretty negative and saw it as, I think, particularly Glenn is seeing it, and I guess Barry as well, which is as a flawed thriller, right? As essentially like a busted thriller. Then I read a really interesting positive review from friend of the show, Tasha Robinson, who said, it's a black comedy. And she really kind of enjoyed it as a black comedy. And what I wound up coming out of this movie with is it's not a good financial skewering at all. Comparisons to The Big Short do not flatter it, and I did not like The Big Short. What it is, I don't think it's a busted financial skewering. I think it's a pretty good media skewering. That's what I saw it as, much more a media skewering. You have to start with the understanding that the entire setup that the guy comes in with a gun and they stay on the air and televise his entire, that I do not think would ever happen. Nope. I don't think any live television studio would be as unprepared for this and as without a plan for what to do as these guys were.
Yeah.
But I think the parts of it that work the best are the parts where they keep kind of going to some of the audiences that are watching all of this unfold in bars and places like that. And you can look at those scenes and think they're very silly, or you can look at those scenes and say, this is kind of the point of the movie, is the way that these people are sitting around kind of digesting this and taking it in. I think it's a really flawed movie. I agree that it's not... I don't think it hangs together, really, but there are parts of it that I really enjoyed. Yeah. There are parts of it that I thought were really clever, and there's a weird... I wound up having, like, a weird affection for it, even though I saw everything that happened in it coming at least a couple of scenes ahead. At the same time, there were a couple of interesting turns, right? There is a moment where the police and the negotiators and everything think they have an angle on how to get through to this guy and get him to kind of lay down his gun and everything and surrender. And it kind of doesn't go the way that they expect. And I found that sort of interesting. I mean, one of the comparisons here is obviously like Dog Day Afternoon. There is a Dog Day Afternoon-y kind of attempt to look at what a ridiculous circus this turns into. And that I thought was much more interesting than anything it has to say about the financial crisis, which is essentially nothing.
It has much more to say about Jim Cramer-style shows. I mean, there's to me, there's a beautiful shot kind of early in this movie where you see them staging this ridiculous, like, little dance routine where he's, you know, wearing a goofy hat and, like, pantsing around, screaming about stocks. And the camera kind of pans around to behind them. And you see them doing this into a completely empty studio. With just like a couple of cameras, and you just realize what a hollow farce this sort of show is. I think you're right. I think that it does have more interesting things to say about shows like this and the media.
I guess all that notwithstanding, I feel like I've seen the critique of the Kramer style show in so many places now and done in so many ways. Like, I've seen it on a Law and Order episode at this point, you know? And so to me, it was even that critique felt hollow when it was not joined with more than just a shaking my fist at Wall Street kind of thing. You know what I mean?
So we were going to talk a little bit coming off of this movie about movie stars, because one of the interesting things is, you know, Julia Roberts at one time was probably one of the biggest movie stars we had, if not the biggest, and so has been Clooney. And In fact, a pretty big movie star at one time was Jodie Foster,
yeah.
who directed this and has directed some other stuff. So there have been a bunch of pieces of writing in the last few years talking about kind of the end of the movie star. And I wonder when you watched this movie, for example, Glenn, when you watched this movie, does the fact that you're seeing kind of movie stars who are good at being movie stars do anything for you in a movie like this?
Well, I mean, you hire George Clooney because this guy is George Clooney-esque, right?
Mm-hmm.
You
mm-hmm.
hire the actor because of the associations that have accreted to them over the years.
Mm-hmm.
So smarm is required. Mm-hmm. George Clooney does smarm.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't necessarily get any of that extra energy off of Julia Roberts because this character is just a competent producer. It's not really
yeah.
a character mm-hmm. there that is informed by Julia Roberts. You just need a competent actor there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, and I've talked a lot in the past about how in movies like Cold Mountain, a novel I loved.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Every time you turn a corner, it's movie star, it's movie star, it's movie
mm-hmm.
star, and that
mm-hmm.
gets really distracting. You're not telling a mm-hmm. story, you're just hiring a lot of Hollywood.
Right.
And it feels distancing. It feels like the end of the film The Player, where mm-hmm. we see Julia Roberts, I think it is, and Bruce Willis, and it's just, they're not the characters, they're Julia Roberts and Bruce Willis. So
yeah.
if the Russos, as you talked to last week, are right, and we're moving to big spectacle
yeah.
films,
mm-hmm.
and shunting quality indie kind of stuff to television, what's happening now with actors is you're burying them under CGI and prosthetics. I mean, you are putting Tom Hardy's beautiful mouth behind a mask. Mistake.
Yeah,
you
always.
You are turning Oscar Isaac, a handsome-looking dude, into basically a Power Rangers villain in
mm-hmm.
X-Men Apocalypse. Mm-hmm. The only one that I thought really made sense to me and that was useful was Scarlett Johansson's role in Her.
Sure.
Because
mm-hmm.
that's about the performance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That is about removing her from the mix.
Mm-hmm.
When a beautiful person says lines, it's very distracting
mm-hmm.
because their facial symmetry just
mm-hmm.
dazzles you
mm-hmm.
and you start thinking about their skincare regimen. But in that film, you heard Scarlett Johansson, the actor, in a way that you hadn't before.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
a mixed bag.
Well, and there's also one of the things that we talked about with Captain Phillips, I believe,
mm-hmm.
was that the casting of Tom Hanks does mm-hmm. a lot of the work
right.
in that
yep.
movie to make that like your hero mm-hmm. that you're going to be pulling for and to kind of invest you in that character.
Bridge of Spies, too.
A lot, yeah,
mm-hmm.
Bridge
oh,
of Spies,
totally.
Too.
Yeah.
A lot of that work. I don't know. How about you, Barry? What do you think? Movie
so
stars.
That match between the person, like you're saying, you know, between the person and the material is really important to me. When it works really well for me with a real movie star, it usually is because they have been pulled up by the level of someone else in the cast.
Oh, interesting.
So, you know, when I think about movies that I have adored, or, you know, when you think about something like 12 Years a Slave,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
you know, there are a couple of movie stars in that, like Brad Pitt, who
yes,
is kind of
right.
a, you know, but because there are some minor, at the time, I mean, now Lupita Nyong'o is
a huge star,
but
sure.
at the time, she was dazzling because she was
yeah.
new
yeah.
and she pulled everybody up and mm-hmm. Fassbender was getting to be a little bit like I maybe seen a little bit too much
sure.
of him.
Yeah.
I mean, not actually not.
No.
I could still stand to see a little
have
more.
Have you seen Shame?
Yes, indeed.
See
I've
a
seen,
lot of
I was going to
yeah.
say that, yeah. But for me, that is what's important. And, you know, I was saying to Glenn earlier, you know, just on my scale of entertainment I like to watch is I really don't care about movie stars that much because I mostly get all of my entertainment jollies from television. When do I see George Clooney? I see him once a year.
Yeah.
But I got real excited when I saw Catriona Balfe because I see her in my iPad
yeah.
every
yeah.
week.
Right. Yeah.
So there's that relationship that I have to the stars that is, you know, for me, I'm just not a movie star person
yeah.
unless it's Cary Grant.
Yeah. How about you, Thompson?
I think when we talk about the way George Clooney and Julia Roberts came up into gigantic movie stardom, a lot of the context for that was in how much they got paid
mm-hmm.
per movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Clooney got, I think, $20 million for Ocean's 11. I believe she got $25
mm-hmm.
million dollars for something or other.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, like, their movie stardom was measured in how much money they made.
Mm-hmm.
And by extension, how much they were expected to, quote unquote, open a picture.
Mm-hmm. Right, sure.
And how many movie stars today, just them, have the power to create a big box office draw. I mean, I would argue if you just talk about a person, the most consistent box office draw of recent years is probably Melissa McCarthy. But what's interesting when you look at the bankability and you look at the movies that have made these stars the most money, using that as a metric
mm-hmm.
for movie stardom, so often it boils down to not the movie star, but the character
mm-hmm.
that they're playing and the
right.
franchise in which they're involved.
Right.
I think the biggest movie star money-wise right now is Robert Downey Jr.
Yep.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why is it Robert Downey? If Robert Downey Jr. got cast in a romantic drama,
Or, for example, in The Judge.
Or The Judge with Robert Duvall, which no one cared.
Yeah, no one cared.
Like, Robert Downey Jr. can make a skadillion dollars if he's playing Iron Man. Right. Jennifer Lawrence, you know, which is another example I brought, I think you would say she's making the most money playing mm-hmm. Katniss Everdeen. She's right. either in movies that David O. Russell directs or she's playing Katniss yeah. Everdeen.
Or X-Men.
You're right. Right. So you have franchises and a like certain signature director mm-hmm. that she's mm-hmm. working with. But she's not necessarily a guaranteed draw just because it's her.
Right.
Will Smith. If Will Smith had been in the Independence Day movie, there'd be a ton of money behind that. If he mm-hmm. were, you know, like a Men in Black sequel mm-hmm. versus a movie like Concussion. So it's so much about the mm-hmm. roles themselves and the franchises that mm-hmm. those performances are tied to.
Yeah. And I think for me, when I think about movie stars, I think about a couple different things, right? One is the kind of the action star, like mm-hmm. Steven Seagal or, you know, Schwarzenegger was.
Or Tom Cruise.
Or Liam Neeson, amazingly.
Right, exactly. So I think you have a certain kind of movie star in the sense that they can go into a kind of specific kind of movie and do the thing they do in that movie, right? The other kind is the kind that sort of that I associate more with like the 90s. The stars like Julia Roberts and Clooney and people like that, who to me were part of that middle that we've talked about collapsing out of movies,
yeah.
which is as movies go more and more toward either tiny indies or giant blockbusters.
I thought about that middle so much with Money Monster.
This middle, mm-hmm. which was where not only a movie like Money Monster would live, but also any adult drama, any romantic comedy, any live-action family movie,
yeah.
sports movies, these kinds of, they're not blockbusters, but they're commercial. Anything like that, those movies are really in much shorter supply, it mm-hmm. seems to me. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily going for Oscars, but like this is where rom-coms went, as I said. So those movie stars, I think, really capitalized on that kind of whole market where you didn't necessarily have to get into a franchise. But think about somebody like Daniel Radcliffe,
yeah.
right? The willingness of people to go see Daniel Radcliffe in other movies besides the Harry Potter movies
yeah.
really makes you question whether Daniel Radcliffe is a movie star.
Sure.
Right.
How is that possible? Those movies have made an unbelievable amount of money.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And yet, is he a movie star? That's a really interesting question. Yeah. And I think the point that you raise about Downey is a similar question. It's sort of like, are you a movie star or are you
really,
you
really good at playing
into,
Iron Man?
Right. Have you slotted right. into movies that are stars in a way?
Yeah.
I find the whole thing kind of fascinating. The franchisiness and all this other stuff.
When you talk about that middle and in the 90s, and again, this is making me feel like an old lady, but I'm thinking about like Melanie Griffith and mm-hmm. Working Girl and mm-hmm. those great. And I think maybe my bitter, like I have, there's definitely a bitterness I have, is that I feel like a movie like this would have been a Working Girl. It would have been a different kind of yeah. a movie in the 90s, and it would have had a star that I could relate to. It would have, and this to me, I'm like, well, if this is the material that is going to prop yeah. up George Clooney
sure.
and Julia Roberts, I don't know that they're going to be stars for that much longer.
But I
if
agree.
They can't find themselves a suit to get into and fly around,
right? I think when you look at a lot of these movies, what you see is like Cable,
mm-hmm.
Afternoon, mm-hmm. and maybe that's an okay,
yeah.
You know, maybe that's where the world is kind of going. I think that is what Joe Russo was saying to me yeah. in that interview mm-hmm. That we ran on the show last week. Is essentially, you know, a lot of that stuff is not going to be necessarily theatrical movies. Anyway, I will be fascinated to hear how many of you took yourselves out to see Money Monster, but also feel free to share your thoughts about other movie stars. You certainly have your franchise stars, your Pratts and your other lovely geniuses that I love so much, your Chrises of all kinds. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH and let us know what you think. When we come back, you've literally asked for it. Now, often you say, you've asked for it, and now we're going to do it. You've literally asked for us to talk about Eurovision, and now we're going to do it right after this.
Let's take a moment to thank and share a message from our sponsor, Airbnb. When you travel with Airbnb, you can live in over 2 million homes around the world. You don't have to experience a city like a tourist. Don't go to Paris to wait in lines. Don't go to LA to take a bus tour. And don't go to Tokyo to pose for the same photos. Paint the view from your host's garden. Wake up to the sunrise on a houseboat. Or have someone ask you for directions. Feel at home, explore your host's neighborhood, and truly experience a city. Live there, even if it's just for a night. Airbnb.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Before the break, we were talking about movie stars, but if you want to see stars, like really stars, as in people you cannot see anything like them anywhere else, you need to watch the Eurovision Song Contest. Now, this is the first year that the Eurovision Song Contest, that the big final spectacular, was aired in the United States live. It was on Logo. Thank you, Logo.
Makes sense.
It was on Logo. It was Carson Kressley and
Michelle Collins.
Michelle Collins. And they were doing what I would describe as kind of mystery science
theater. Exactly. Wrote that down.
They were kind of narrating as third parties, kind of narrating the broadcast as opposed to the actual thing. But the Eurovision Song Contest is this. It has existed for decades. It is wildly, massively popular. It is watched by hundreds of millions of people. And in it, the countries of Europe and some other places.
Mm-hmm. And also Australia.
Confusingly.
Other places that
you might not traditionally think of as European countries, like Israel, but are European countries for the purposes of this. The European countries and their friends get together, and each qualifying country, an original song that is performed by whatever artist. So these are singers from these various countries. They perform an original song. Mm-hmm. And then at the end, there's an hours-long judging process.
Oh, yeah.
It takes forever.
Right. It takes forever.
And they don't even really get right.
And this year, the winner was Ukraine over Russia, which was one of the favorites to win, and Australia, which looked like they were going to win for a while.
And was awesome.
That's right. So I feel like my spirit guide on Eurovision, especially based on following Twitter, is Glenn Weldon. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to turn it over to Glenn. Glenn, speak to me of Eurovision.
I had never seen it before because, again, if I had to see it in years past, I would have had to make an effort of some kind, and that's just not me.
No.
So here's the formula. You take American Idol, you add Sabado Gigante, put parentheses around that, then you multiply that by Solid Gold.
Yes.
Then you put to the power of whatever to up in the
right,
little
sure.
thing, to the power of RuPaul's Drag Race. Then you divide that whole sum by Model UN, right. And you have Eurovision Song Contest.
Yep.
This made me so happy. It made Madame Day. It made Madame...
Glenn's got layers, I'm telling you.
It made Madame life knowing that this will be in my life for the rest of it. Every year, I will look forward to this and have people over. It's so... The reason I never got into, say, American Idol or The Voice is because it's about the individual, right? It's about somebody getting up there and doing a song we've heard a million times, covering like a Whitney song plus melisma, and that's all you get out of it, right? Mm-hmm. It's the
plus
individual.
Plus more melisma.
More melisma.
Melisma plus hand.
Exactly. Here, they are representing their country. So it's not about them per se, although it kind of is. It's really about nationalism, but this weird, absurd, cute kind of nationalism.
In this way, it's
super shimmery.
It's pageanty. Yeah. It's like being Miss Delaware or whatever.
And it's just people waving flags and getting excited about a song, a piece of fluff, a bubblegum song. So it kind of, in a way, implicitly parodies the notion of nationalism itself. It's kind of a way to say, like, you're getting excited about this. You are rallying around this. And here's another thing. I have met a lot of Europeans. They tend to be, in my experience, less hung up about sex, about homosexuality, bisexuality, but just less hung up, less rigid about sex. And I have always attributed that to the fact that we in the United States were founded by pilgrims and Puritans.
Sure.
So shame is part of our, you know, cultural DNA.
Sure.
It's right there. Yeah. I think the Eurovision Song Contest has a great deal to do with the fact that Europe... is pretty okay with a couple, Russia is not
notable exceptions.
Russia is not hosting the GLAAD Awards anytime soon.
Right.
But if you are an 8-year-old gay kid in Luxembourg, right, and this is beamed into your home, into your living room every year, you would know, nothing about gay sex per se, but you would know that there is a sensibility that is yours.
Right.
That
right.
These are my people.
Yeah.
In America, you have to be lucky enough to have adults who would take you to musical theater. But here, it's in the ether.
I mean, is it that?
I'm giving Glenn a dubious look. I'm not sure we actually know how forward-looking Europe is about gay kids in every case.
But I understand your point.
Is it that much different in sensibility than, say, the Olympics?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Because
it's only
figure skating. You know what I mean? It's only ice skating.
It's if all the Olympics was the
right, exactly.
This thing started off with a fashion show of just people in all kinds of paper mache outfits. It was basically like gay Mumenschanz, basically. Right. And that's how they introduced. So if the opening ceremonies of the Olympics were gayer.
Right.
Because again.
Way gayer.
Way gayer. I loved it.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit about the music. What I will say about the music, I thought a lot about how am I going to explain how I reacted to this music. And then I realized that my best description is that the Eurovision Song Contest is made up of songs where somewhere between 30 and 90% of the song is the final countdown.
right.
It sounds somewhere between 30% like the final countdown and 90% like the final countdown.
Yeah.
That was my reaction to the music. I don't know.
One of my objections to the music, there were 26 songs from 26 countries.
Yes, there was.
And what bothered me was how much of those songs sounded exactly the same.
Uh-huh. Like how I much, loved it. I was like thinking like the best sewing factory ever.
Like big, moist, synth, kind of majestic synth pop.
That was awesome.
Anthems with lots of belting. There was a woman, I believe it was the one from Italy, who was dressed like a Fabergé egg.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of big goofy outfits, but the music was so samey. I really liked it when I got a little bit of a sense that genre-wise, somebody was poking at just trying to do
like
something.
Like the country singer
from the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to bring up the guy from the Netherlands whose name is Dawa Bob. And not just like a country singer, they sounded like the Jayhawks.
Right.
It was like all of a sudden, and unfortunately he was so early. He was like the third one to perform out of 26. Mm-hmm. But I was like, oh, okay, there's going to be a lot of different genres here. Like all of a sudden there are all these rich harmonies and it sounded like the Jayhawks.
And I will say Cowboy Joe is below the 30% threshold for the final countdown.
Right.
Sounds actually nothing like Final Countdown. Right. He was the exception to the rule.
If the Jayhawks had a gigantic neck tattoo.
Yep.
True. I don't know. How was this for you, Barry?
I'm on the Glenn team of like, this was like an IV of sequins. You know, it could not have been any more fun for me. I would listen to the final countdown again and again because I really do want to like come to the edge of the cliff and then fall off again and again. I mean, it's
you
so
want to pump your
much.
Fist with all the
actually, you get
dance
a really good
pop.
Singer like Australia.
I think a lot of them were good singers.
Right. Yeah. I mean, but something where you really get a little chill down your back.
Sure.
You know, I mean, for me, the thing that it just made me feel like is God, I wish the Olympics, I wish they would make the ice dancers sing.
Yeah.
I mean, that was really, like, that would be the thing. And again, I'm with Glenn. I mean, the thing of, like, that you are representing your country using art in this weird competition is so much, it's so exciting to me. And this was a really good one to watch because there was this minor diplomatic incident in which Russia was really mad that Ukraine won because they won with this song sung by Jamala called 1944, which was about her grandmother who had gotten caught up in the wave of a mass deportation of ethnic Tatars from Crimea in 1944.
Right. And that incident, I mean, you're not supposed to be singing political songs in this competition. And there are certainly modern resonances with more recent incidents in that region. And I think you also had, you could argue that there were stronger songs, certainly stronger vocals. I felt that Jamala's had some breath control issues in her performance that you didn't necessarily hear in a performance by someone like Dami Im, who was the Australian singer who ended up being the runner-up.
She was wonderful.
Who just had a tremendous voice, mm-hmm. a very, very catchy kind of electropop sound.
Totally.
I was really glad to see that embraced over, for example, the 24th place UK team. Was it Jake and Joe or Joe and Jake? Just this very generic kind of boy bandy dudes.
I know, but they were so cute.
They were very cute, Joe and Jake. And I sort of thought like, oh man, you know, the whitest, catchiest, poppiest thing
I thought it was going to be.
No,
but here's what I figured out. The UK, and I could be wrong, I'm completely making this up. This is a one-time viewing thing.
Sure.
Is that maybe the UK in Eurovision is like the United States in soccer.
I was just going to say.
Where it seems like you're a big deal, but actually you're not.
Right.
They treat you like a big deal.
Yeah.
And you treat yourself like you're a big deal.
Joe and Jake are the men's soccer team.
But actually, you're very unlikely to win is what I mean. And I love our soccer team. Don't get me wrong. I love soccer players. I'm just saying you're unlikely to win.
Sure. Now, here's the thing. You've heard the phrase over the top. The top is the floor. The top is, and that floor is alive with lasers and flames and smoke and glitter and snow. But I just wanted to give a few shout outs. So the Azerbaijan performance, a woman with backup dancers, one of her backup dancers is in white tights, shirtless, with gold lame football shoulder pads.
Yep.
That's when I knew it was going to be good. Serbia has a kind of Morticia Adams woman with a bunch of other kind of Morticia Adams people in black pleather.
Yeah.
And there's a dude who is dancing around them. And every so often he comes up to her and he puts his hands on her and she totally pushes him away and he spins away down on the floor. It's like the goth I Will Survive, basically is what that is. Croatia had the woman in the giant pup tent that then the monks come up and just rip off the robe and then she's there. She's got a better dress underneath. Russia. Now, Russia had this screen that the guy stood in front of and kind of climbed all over and was really impressive. But it's like the images on the screen were like him with angel wings.
Giant wings.
The name of the song could have been, "This is what I would look like on the side of a van." This is what I would look like.
If he were a vampire. This is the Transylvanian entrance.
And finally, Armenia, the last act of the evening, was kind of working. This is very nationalistic and solipsistic to say. It seemed like several people were doing a Beyoncé thing, serving you variations of Beyoncé. But then I realized this is Beyoncé without soul. If you could somehow leach the blackness from Beyoncé, what you'd be left with is this person here, talent and hair.
Yeah,
that's what you got right there.
Yep.
And performing with like holograms of herself, it was a little unclear. I'm surprised that you forgot Poland,
which was
the guy who kind of looked like a young, lithe Weird Al Yankovic.
Oh, sure.
In like a long, red, slightly vampiric
Kenny G. Bandler.
And so they had these little interstitial bits introducing them, and you would see footage of the musician in his or her habitat.
Yeah.
And the Poland guy, at one point you see him feeding a nut to a squirrel and then
That's
somehow
amazing.
The music was like 40% more earnest than that.
So the hosts were actually really good. I thought
so
a guy named Monts and a woman
Monts
named
was a previous winner,
right? Last year's winner,
right?
And was really smooth and really good, and it's nice to know that lame filler stage banter is an international language. Although some of the stuff was really good. At one point, because the show wasn't long enough, they decided they needed to do some filler stuff. So they introduced this concept of here's how you make the perfect Eurovision song.
Yes.
And the song that they created. Now, on one level, it's basically this is the song that goes like this from, you know, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. But on the other, this was my favorite song of the evening.
Yeah.
Let the song begin with passion. Let the wind begin to blow. You can break the rules of fashion and your chance to win shall grow. Look into the TV camera so the audience can see that you're lovable, not desperate. Smile and they will vote for me. Fill the stage with light as dancers will join us. The expectations grow. It's time for the chorus. Love, love, peace, peace for women baking bread. Peace, peace, love, love, and a man in a hamster wheel.
And a man in a hamster wheel.
And a man in a hamster wheel.
Oh man, I loved it so much.
Yeah, I loved it too.
Oh, that was so. It's
and true.
And
it's funny and true.
Just a sense of humor about itself. The Tonys can do that. The Tonys can make fun of themselves because those are actors and those are theater people. They have a sense of irony. When the Oscars try to do anything like that, it is dead because those people have no sense of humor about themselves.
Right.
They're pompous jerks.
They're genuinely there to be celebrated.
They are genuinely there to be celebrated. This was so. It was the high point of the evening.
And
of a very high point.
Yeah. They were there. The Oscars. They're there because they're genuinely famous. I mean, the thing about Eurovision is that this rarely translates to anything.
It's
only
it has with
Celine Dion.
Celine Dion
and
ABBA.
Right.
Well,
this
there are a couple
not,
people who, after they were famous, somehow performed on Eurovision.
Right.
Katrina and the Waves won in, like, the late 90s.
Right.
Lulu
and apparently Sergei Lazarov is a real deal thing. But it's varying. I think you lose the ability to take yourself seriously once you are really, really rich.
Right. One of the things that I was thinking about while I was watching it was, I feel weird if I'm watching this ironically mm-hmm. as an American, as yeah. like a kind of like Carson Kressley American, and people really love it and they work really hard. And I felt weird about it because I wasn't sure whether do the people who really love it, are they watching it ironically? Do they have a sense of humor about it? Am I just stomping over somebody right. else's like enjoyable cultural thing? Because I don't enjoy necessarily being that person.
Right.
So to learn that, oh, no, this is all part of it, right?
Yep.
It doesn't mean they don't
yeah.
really love it. But that to recognize this kind of the silliness and grandiosity of some of the postures
mm-hmm.
that people are assuming. No, no, that's all part of it. That's yeah. all included.
Yeah.
You get to do everything.
It's free.
And it's not like when they show, like when they're singing in the song about a flaming piano and then there is a flaming piano.
Yes.
I just think that one sounds the most like the Final Countdown.
Yeah,
that,
right.
Like, it makes sense. I don't know. It all hangs yeah. together for me.
I will say my experience of watching this, and I felt this from the first 5 minutes of watching this, was I thought, I watched it by myself, and I thought, every additional person who watches this with me in future years mm-hmm. is going to be a multiplier
yes.
of my enjoyment. If I watch this with 2 people, mm-hmm. I will enjoy it twice as much. If mm-hmm. I watch it with 8 people, I will enjoy it
yep.
8 times as much.
Yeah, yeah. I thought about offering to come over and watch it with you, and
damn.
Then I didn't. You know,
I should have had.
I have to say, every year, because I work in news, every year we have a meeting and where we say, oh my God, are we going to cover Eurovision? And every year it's like this weird joke in the meeting where we sort of like, does it fall on our watch? Do we have to do the thing and whatever?
Do the people in our audience have the ability to see it.
Right, and this right. is the first year that they did mm-hmm. and that is a thing. And now I get it. This is the first year that I really got it. But I think also when you cover it as an American, when you really are doing like news coverage
sure.
and you're doing like the clips, and I've yeah. done this with so many hosts before, you lose the fun of, which is really just like sitting down with your friends and
yeah.
just with a big sequin grin.
I mean, this is like the Super Bowl, but
yeah.
even gayer.
But so much yes.
It's fair. It's fair. All right. Well, I know for a fact that a lot of you watched Eurovision. I just know this about you. So come and find us and tell us what you thought. When we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week. And let's face it, every week, what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from Chipotle. For 22 years, they've been committed to sourcing the best responsibly sourced ingredients they can find, prepping them with care, and cooking using simple recipes without the use of artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners. It all takes hours to prepare, but just seconds to serve. Whether they're marinating, braising, grilling, chopping, slicing, dicing, or mashing, they're putting the food back in fast food, one burrito at a time.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
A few months ago, I talked about the fact that my now 12-year-old daughter has become a huge fan of horror movies. And I did a call out asking for people to recommend what are some horror titles that would be appropriate to a child of that age. And a bunch of people wrote in very, very helpfully. My mom sent me a bunch of stuff.
Sure.
As she's wont to do. And I think a plurality of people's suggestions centered on the movie Scream
mm-hmm.
and the Scream trilogy, which eventually there was a fourth one, etc. And finally, this weekend, my daughter and I finally sat down and watched it together. And we had a high old time, really, really enjoyed it. There was a reference in the movie to Carrie and what book is now in my daughter's backpack. She is now reading Stephen King's Carrie because she's interested in it, because it got referenced in this horror movie she liked. And very much a precursor to Cabin in the Woods. They are doing a lot of the same meta stuff with horror. And I think for a kid who's just starting out as, I think, a bone-deep enthusiast of this genre, she really, really loves it. Having a lot of the mechanisms of horror taken apart and shown to her
mm-hmm.
kind of in the beginning,
oh, yeah.
Especially with a lot of references to other horror classics that
mm-hmm.
she's now going to go back and mm-hmm. be interested in, has been really nice. And for me, seeing this movie 20 years later, I had the funniest experience about, I don't know, 15 minutes into it, where I sat there and I'm like, that's David Arquette. I hate David Arquette. Why do I hate David Arquette? And I spent like 20 minutes of this movie like, why do I hate David Arquette? I hate David Arquette because David Arquette was in those 1-800-CALL-ATT ads.
Down the middle.
And then it got me down this whole rabbit hole of, remember when all the commercials on TV were for cheaper collect calling services?
card calls.
Like 20 years ago, like those were half the commercials on TV. I mean, billions and billions and billions of dollars.
We're going into kind of an old man Thompson kind of place.
It's a little bit of a, for our younger listeners, look up that whole world of commercials. I mean, Mr. T was in one that was like, save a buck or two. But it wasn't even saving a dollar or two for you. It was saving a buck or two for the person you were calling. It confused me even then, and I'm old. So anyway, I have decided, among other things, that
I love what's coming after anyway.
So anyway, I greatly enjoyed Scream, but I've also decided 20 years later that I forgive David Arquette.
Oh, nice.
I've decided that I like David Arquette. I will no longer punish David Arquette for his role in these absolutely excruciating commercials in which he would sort of, with this like adenoidal scream, like scream at you to C-A-L-L-A-T-T. Oh, I hated that guy. I no longer hate you, David Arquette. Oh. I forgive you. I root for you. That is what is making
his
me
happy.
His
happy had a character arc. How about that? It sounded like he had an epiphany.
All right. Thank you very much, I think, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
Well, this isn't making me happy, but the artist and writer Darwin Cook, comic book artist and writer, passed away this weekend of a very sudden aggressive cancer. That's not making me happy. What is making me happy are the remembrances of him and his art. I met him briefly a couple times. He struck me always as a very humble guy, very sardonic, witty, wry, funny guy, who was incredibly generous with praise. Like he wanted to talk to you about the kids who were coming up, the writers and artists that he really liked. He wanted to share that with you. His style was always very open and bright and charming, the antithesis of what a lot of comics were doing in the 90s and beyond. And he was inspired, as a lot of people were, by Will Eisner and Jack Kirby, but also of the kind of mid-century commercial illustration. You can kind of see that in his work in a big way. His work didn't look like anybody else's, though. He had a really open, bright, hopeful style. Even when he's doing work like he adapted some of the Donald Westlake Parker novels, very aggressive, pulpy stuff, but still great. He and Ed Brubaker basically rebooted Catwoman at one point and turned her from a fetish object into a character. That was pretty cool. A character who was still sexy and kind of owned her sexuality, but not what she was before. What most people are talking about this last weekend was his probably magnum opus, I guess, called DC The New Frontier, which was a 6-issue miniseries where he reimagined the DC comics of the space age, basically, late 50s, early 60s, which is when originally in the history of DC comics, it's when the Justice League got started. And he had these designs that were kind of that moment. And if it was just that, if it was just like, here's a boomerang table and here's a car with fins and here's like, that would be great because it would be gorgeous because he was a meticulous craftsman, a draftsman. But he understood that the comics of that era, of necessity, because where the country was, if you were going to write about the Justice League, you were basically writing about 7 lantern-jawed white dudes. Mm-hmm. And he thought, that's eliding a big part of this history. And if I'm going to retell this history, if I'm going to reimagine it, what he did was he inserted a black superhero into the mix, not into that mix, but basically coloring to reflect the civil rights unrest. And it informed one of the stealth themes of this book, which is, if we allow segregation, lynching, is humanity worth saving by these so-called superheroes? Which is a really interesting thing to wrestle with in this bright, colorful thing where there's also superheroes punching dinosaurs. So you got that. He was able to blend these things without bringing it down, without making it depressing, but always with a sense of hope. So he will be sorely missed. So you check out anything you can by him. But if you want to start with the DC New Frontier, you wouldn't do yourself any disservice.
Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Barry Hardiman, what is making you happy this week?
So this is going to be a long way to get somewhere, but I went to Book Expo last week, which is a big...
Which is a big
book industry meeting where we talk to publishers and we get pitched all of the new exciting things that are coming out. And there's a lot of, well, you know, so-and-so has a new novel and, you know, this and that and the other thing. So bear with me. I've been watching The Night Manager because of Tom Hiddleston.
Sure.
And Hugh Laurie for different reasons.
Sure.
It is fine. It's totally serviceable and super fun to watch. And I could certainly recommend it to any one of our listeners. But what it made me think about is that I have actually never read any John le Carré because I kept confusing. I really sort of confused the Bond novels with it. And I thought, oh, I probably won't like that. So I spent all of last week, because I had all this travel time, reading The Spy That Came in Cold and Smiley's People and rereading. This guy's awesome, this John le Carré fella. He is so great. So it meant I spent all of Book Expo. You know, people kept trying to, you know, oh, well, you know, we've got new Ann Patchett. We've got new Michael Shea. I was like, have you heard of this whippersnapper named John le Carré? So anyway, if you find yourself, you know, I mean, everybody likes to watch Tom Hiddleston smoldering with any number of people. And I love, I'll watch Hugh Laurie do anything. But I really, I got to highly recommend, if you have missed this, if this is a hole in your reading, go back and read The Spy That Came in from the Cold. It is really, it is so beautifully and deftly put together. There is a real point of view, you know, and some of the later novels, I mean, I really kind of tore through them because they go real quick. I mean, you know, he doesn't have that much use for women, but they gets a little better in like maybe the last three, but that's fine. I mean, you know, what are you going to do? It's like, he's, you know, but at the same time, he really is sort of growing into this idea that, you know, spycraft is really at odds with Western values in these ways. Anyway, it is so marvelous, and I have to highly recommend these.
John le Carré. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I just made it, I just a little vintage recommend.
There absolutely. Sure. No, that's wonderful.
Exactly. Many publicists looked at me with quizzical eyebrows.
Thank you very much, Barry Hardiman. So what I have this week is related to the fact that there were a whole bunch of TV shows that were canceled in a short period of time last week, and one of them was The Grinder, which was a really fun comedy that Rob Lowe and Fred Savage starred in. I really enjoyed it. I did not see it all the time, but I saw it often enough to know that I liked it and that I will miss it. And one of the people who was in The Grinder was Natalie Morales, not the one who is on the Today Show, but a different one. She is a terrific actress. She was Tom Haverford's girlfriend, Lucy, on Parks and Rec. She was the best friend on Trophy Wife. You all know how much I love Trophy Wife. She's been in a bunch of things. She's terrific, incredibly reliable. She's one of those actresses where if you put her into a comedy, it is instantly funnier and more lively. And when The Grinder was canceled, she took to Snapchat. And there is a series of Snapchats that she eventually, they were strung together into a video that we can link to, where first it kind of chronicles her after this cancellation news drinking quite a lot. She's got herself like in a bar, I believe with Malin Ackerman at one point from Trophy Wife. She's drinking, she's unhappy. And then there is a sequence in which she breaks into the studio, she breaks into the lot where they shot The Grinder, to take with her some mementos. And what happens in this series of Snapchats is so weird and great and so human, because on the one hand, it's sort of a put on, right? But I also think it's clearly real. It's really, you know, an actor who really had a job that she loved and the job is ending. And it was this very humanizing thing at this time when there's a churn where all the shows are getting taken off and the new shows are coming on and most of them are going to fail, but that's okay because we're going to boot the old ones anyway, even if they were good. And it was really interesting to have this very alive project that she did. And it's really funny. It's kind of like her skulking around at the studio. It's great. And I will link to it. You can follow her, Natalie Morales, on Snapchat at NatmoSnaps. I'm a fan of her, and I was bummed that she lost her gig. I look forward to seeing her again really soon, and I very much enjoyed her willingness to share the ups and, in this case, the downs of being an actress with a regular show. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPRMonkeyC. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. And you can follow Barry at B. Hardiman. That's B-H-A-R-D-Y-M-O-N. You can follow our regular producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. And producing with us this week is Samantha Balaban. Thank you so much, Samantha. You can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thanks so much to you guys for all being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
We We wanted to let you know that one of our favorite NPR podcasts is back. Invisibilia returns with Season 2 on June 17th. Invisibilia explores the invisible forces that shape human behavior, thoughts, emotions, assumptions, expectations. This season, Invisibilia goes to a prison, an oil rig, a McDonald's in Russia, and a beach in New Jersey to explore the invisible forces at play in our institutions, work, family, and governments. You can catch up on Season 1 of Invisibilia at any time and listen to the Season 2 preview starting on May 20th at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.